Hello, and welcome to Profiles. I'm Owen Johnson. It's a pleasure to visit with someone who, along with the magazine she edits, plays an important role in political and policy discussions in the United States. She's Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and, since 2005, the publisher of The Nation, one of the oldest continuously published magazines in the United States. Katrina, welcome to Profiles.
Thank you.
I think people hear the name Katrina and they think of something else. Has your life changed since 2005 because of the hurricane?
My life hasn't changed. I feel some terrible sadness that my name has become associated with this tragedy in New Orleans, an American tragedy. It's not just New Orleans. My sense of what happened in New Orleans is not – that it's symptomatic of the problems in America. It's not just unique to New Orleans. Rush Limbaugh tried to – destroy my life, but I'm not going to let a thug like Mr. Limbaugh do that. When he started calling Hurricane Katrina Vandenhoevel, in the midst, in the unfolding of the tragedy, not weeks later, I take some small measure of comfort in reading the media today. Paul Krugman, for example, in the New York Times had a column just last week marking the second year of the hurricane called Katrina All the Time, which was a reflection on the lethal incompetence of this administration and how it has undermined the view of government by mismanaging government. Conservatives who hate government should not be running our government. In any case, my personal life has not changed. However, I do understand that if I do something important in later life, there's never any way that I'll see Katrina as many times as I've seen it in these last years.
And it's a little hard, I suppose, to say, as many people do say, since Katrina.
Well, it's very strange, Owen. I have to say I sit in meetings where people will talk about Katrina, since Katrina, the metastasizing corruption of this administration, Iraq, and Katrina contributed to the outcome of election 2006. So it's eerie. There's a dissonance. And I don't think the name Katrina is going to be very popular. In fact, I did read a survey a few weeks ago in the New York Times that Katrina has dropped severely in the rankings of baby names, and it's now just a little bit above Adolf. This is not. But my name comes my grandfather, who I never met. My grandfather on my father's side was one of 18 children from a seafaring family in Zeeland, Holland, who came to America in 1926. My father was not from a Mayflower Dutch crowd. When he learned I was going to be born, though I never met him, he said, "What about Katrina? It's my favorite name." So I'm not Kate. I'm not Catherine. I'm Katrina for a good reason. So I will try and do my name proud in some ways to repair the damage.
You're mentioning your paternal grandfather. Allows us to get into this area. You have a fascinating family background, it seems to me. Your maternal grandfather was Jules Stein, who was something of, I guess you could say, a Hollywood mogul. What was it like having him as a grandfather?
You know, in many ways, he wasn't one of the traditional Hollywood moguls because he was very much a businessman. But what his legacy is the Jules Stein Eye Institute at UCLA.
Which he was an ophthalmologist, right?
He was an ophthalmologist who trained – he's from Indiana. He was born in South Bend. He trained at the University of Chicago, did a year in Vienna, was an ophthalmologist, and went to work at Cook County Hospital. And on the side, he would book bands. And I guess at some point a patient said to him, "Hey, Jules, you know, hey, what are you going to do, my eyes or the band?" And he chose to go with the bands. So he created what became one of the premier agencies, the agents. So he was really an agent in many ways. But he returned to ophthalmology later in life and helped endow and build the Jules Stein Eye Institute and also something called Research to Prevent Blindness. But MCA was a kind of star-spangled octopus in the entertainment industry, which is what the Saturday Evening Post four-part series in 1946 called it. He wasn't a mogul in the sense that he was very self-effacing. He liked to be behind the scenes. But growing up, I did spend a lot of time in Los Angeles. And when I was young, you know, I remember meeting Cary Grant, and Alfred Hitchcock would come to dinner, and Warren Beatty remembers my grandfather introducing Ronald Reagan to him. I mean, Jimmy Stewart, you know, would go by and say hi. So I grew up thinking, you know, these were ordinary people in any case, but he contributed a sense of entrepreneurial building. And I think if he were alive today and he didn't really know me as I began my relationship with the nation, we would have fierce disagreements about the politics of the nation, though I think he would be shocked by how far these extremists slash conservatives have taken our politics. But he would respect the passion and the building of an institution and the respect for and the carrying on of a legacy like the nation.
Would you have called him one of the kind of traditional Northeast Republicans that have almost disappeared from face of the earth?
I would. What was curious about him, and again, we had disagreements, as did my mother, who's very much the free radical spirit in the family. He was Ronald Reagan's agent. And I think it's but he was surprised by how far Ronald Reagan got in moving our politics. He was not a Reagan Republican, because I do think in Reagan you see the roots of some of the extreme conservatism, though his sunny face masked some of it. But yes, he was more of a Rockefeller Republican, more of a moderate Republican. There was no sense of this kind of social intolerance. And I think he would have been shocked by what's happened to this country. And he, you know, he came out of a different tradition. Again, some of it, I think, a Midwest tradition, because he did, you know, he spent a lot of time in Chicago before moving to L.A., and he was from Indiana.
Now, your parents were both interested in and involved in politics, weren't they?
Passionate. And I think I get a lot of my interest and fascination with politics from just absorbing it in my home. You know, at age one, for better or worse, I campaigned for my father, who was running for Congress in the Silk Stocking District, as they called it, in New York City, running against John Lindsay, who later went on to many things, mayor, presidential candidate. But as I grew up, there was a sense of engagement with public issues, engagement with a history of liberalism and the Democratic Party. But on my mother's side, also a much more radical spirit, radical in cultural ways. She was involved with artists and photographers and writers, so that you had that kind of more freewheeling spirit. My father, you know, his career and his sense of mission and purpose has been very important to me. I value his wisdom because he is a populist, an unrepentant New Dealer, but very pragmatic. And it's that sort of pragmatism combined, allied with a sense of what this country could be, that I respect. So he worked for Bobby Kennedy. He worked in the Justice Department in the Kennedy administration. And I think one thing he is most proud of, which we talk about, is that as a very young Justice Department member, he was sent to Prince Edward County out, you know, in Virginia, because the white community had shut down the schools. They were determined to keep them segregated after various legal rulings. And in the course of the year, my father, with the Ford Foundation and other means, opened up charter private schools, before those were known as such, for the black community. And it was a very important step, and I think one that he valued because it was doing good with government. And that's something that I have grown up with. So I take much from them, and I'm very close to them. I feel younger than I should reasonably do because they're such important parts of my life. My mother, when I was young, maybe 12, worked on a book called Edie about Andy Warhol's superstar, Edie Sedgwick. The book, not quite the book, but the story was a movie made recently with Sienna Miller and others. So, you know, when growing up, you have Andy Warhol traipsing through your living room, and Edie Sedgwick just burned herself out of the Chelsea Hotel and is living in your sister's bedroom, and you're kind of wondering what's going on. And your mother is also raising funds for the Pentagon Papers trial and the Chicago 7 or 8 or 9. It was an entry point into part of our history, living history. So it's but both of my parents, interestingly, did books about Bobby Kennedy. My mother's, called American Journey, was done with George Plimpton. And my father's was much more of a kind of close and personal perspective. And I think for both of them, these years, Owen, seemed traumatic in many ways. But I was young, but to live in those years in 68, I think both of them felt their lives were turned upside down and not clear where this country was headed.
I'd like to return to some of that, but it is customary on this program for our guests to share some of their music, although sometimes I wonder, with all the boards and organizations you're involved with, people must wonder when you have time to listen to music. The first selection is Fight the Power from the Isley Brothers. What makes this so special for you?
Well, I'm not supposed to say this word on radio, but there's a lot of BS going down in this country, and I think it's, you know, it's time to sort of take that on, skewer it, expose it. And it's a moment to, you know, to, from below, take on the power that has not done too well by this country. So that's part of it. I also just love the power of the rhythm and, just, you know, it gets you dancing and shouting and singing and moving.
Fight the Power by the Isley Brothers, music chosen by our guest on Profiles today, Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation. It might be worthwhile, we were talking about your father and mother, since your father's family or your mother's family came from Indiana originally, were they involved in the Indiana primary in 1968?
I had a half-uncle, and all four of his kids went to Culver Military Academy. And I remember coming for one of their graduation ceremonies with my grandparents, and I was wearing a Bobby Kennedy button. I was nine, and they made me take it off before we went to the ceremony. But my father, when I told him he knew we were coming out to Bloomington, he reminded me of happy memories of working with Kennedy, that they won the Indiana primary in 68. And then, of course, the tragedy of heading to California. But it was a big win. Tough state.
Yeah, it was.
A tough state.
And there's an interesting story also in 1968 when Robert Kennedy was in Indianapolis at the time that Martin Luther King was shot. And the local newspaper buried his efforts to quell any riots on the back page.
Is that right? Well, I mean, I do remember that that got enormous national attention because it was such an important appeal.
How did your parents affect your political views? Because a radical on one side, a traditional moderate Democrat on the other side, you're meeting the Chicago Seven or at least seeing them in your house. How do you form your political views in that kind of environment?
You know, I think you absorb it all as a young person, but then you find your own way. And I think I did that partly. I've been involved with The Nation for a long time. I mean, I went to The Nation as an intern. In school, even in high school, but in college, I studied the McCarthy era. Not Eugene McCarthy, but the McCarthy era of the 50s. And that gave me some insight into the ugly undersides of American history. So I brought with it a sense of the traditional politics of the Democratic Party, the more radical movement politics, and saw that if you don't challenge and dissent and speak your mind, even in perilous times when you can be called un-American, that you're abdicating the true American tradition. So there were different elements that contributed to my political formation, and I take from it different elements. But the nation was an important part, because to me it's an alternative history of the United States. If you look at 142 years of the nation, you can see what was possible, the alternatives that were there, what was lost, and what could still be retrieved. Because I think too many Americans forget that there is a history to be retrieved and updated. But I think just again on my father, who in these last years has been who founded this Eleanor and Franklin Roosevelt Institute. If you took Franklin Roosevelt's Bill of Rights, Economic Bill of Rights, I believe it was 1933, and you took it to the floor of the Congress today, they would throw out the subversive radical document. Well, you know, so you want to retrieve some of that spirit. And so I retrieve from my past what I can.
Did your godparents have any influence? I mean, Roger Baldwin, founder of ACLU, Leonard Bernstein's wife, I mean, fairly radical crowd.
I think Roger Baldwin, and, you know, I don't think of him as a radical, though I think he certainly, you know, when he opposed the entry of the United States into World War I and spoke out against the Red Scare of Palmer raids of a different period, yeah. But I think, he kind of is in the best of the mainstream tradition of America, speaking up for civil liberties. What I found out of Roger Baldwin's work and influence, my father was very much an electoral animal. He loved electoral politics, and I respect that. But I think change in this country comes from many roots and many ways. And in what the ACLU did in founding the ACLU, you see the power of movements, of institutions, of those outside the more traditional electoral process to move our country, to make it more sane, more decent, more just, more democratic. And so at the nation, we're not a movement nor are we a party, but we do see the power of ideas, of movements to change our politics. And Roger Baldwin would always speak his mind. So that was a lesson. Felicia Bernstein was just an extraordinary woman. And she died too young, but a great sense of culture and elegance and a wonderful godmother who, you know, told my mother to not let me have spin the bottle parties. You know, she was more maternal than my mother, who it's true. I was the grown up. My mother, she went off to cover the Pentagon Papers trial for a few weeks, and she's always very loving, but not your normal mother.
I think another very important aspect in your life has been your association with Russia. Mm-hmm. How did that start?
I've been going to Russia since 1978. I went for the first time with a Princeton alumni group. And I went because I was interested. I was studying the McCarthy period. What was it about Russia that so attracted a generation of American thinkers and intellectuals and writers and artists? That began the interest. But then the personal is political. I met Stephen Cohen, an alum of IU, of its Russian studies program. And we met, I have to say, because he knew I was going to Moscow. He thought I had a diplomatic passport because my father was then at the UN in Geneva as the representative, U.S. representative. And he asked if I would bring out smuggle out some documents from dissidents. Well, it turned out I didn't have a diplomatic passport, but we got to know each other. And then for 4 years, Steve could not get a visa, partly because of his relationship with dissidents and his work on Nikolai Bukharin, who was then not rehabilitated and was persona non grata, the former Bolshevik leader who was killed by Stalin. But in 1984, Gorbachev came to power. And we went back in March 1985, weeks after Gorbachev came to power. And to have that front row seat on the unfolding of perestroika and glasnost at a moment when I felt American politics was kind of stagnant was extraordinary. It was a country coming alive. It was a country waking after years of stagnation. And I had the good fortune to work at one of the leading glasnost newspapers, Moscow News, under Yegor Yakovlev, crusading glasnost editor. I did interviews with Robert Conquest, writer on the Gulag, with Ralph Nader, introducing the consumer rights movement to Russia in Izvestia, and with a great dissident, Valery Chalidze. And I covered the Congress of People's Deputies, those first elections. In any case, it was to see a country's politics change. Every day there was some opening, some change. Now it's more grim. It's a country, I think, of enormous complexities and contradictions and squandered opportunities. But those Gorbachev years were extraordinary. And I covered and wrote about him for The Nation and for other publications. And I try to maintain some tie. I just wrote recently about Anna Politkovskaya, the journalist who was murdered, maintained ties with the newspaper she worked for, which is an outpost of sort of freewheeling opposition. And it's a country that continues to fascinate me. And we go, and our daughter, Nika, who's 16, we took her for the first time when she was 2 months old. It was still the Soviet Union. She speaks some Russian. And it's just a country which has great, we just feel such warmth and love for the best of its traditions and people.
Would it be possible to say that the Moscow News of the late 1980s would be very similar to what The Nation does?
I would say that Novaya Gazeta today,
that's Politkovskaya's
paper. Politkovskaya's paper is, in a sense, what The Nation is. It's dissident. It's oppositionist. It's muckraking. It's investigative. It exposes abuses of oligarchical and government power. And I think we're closer, in a sense, to Novaya Gazeta. Moscow News was, a different – I just remember, Yegor Yakovlev crossing the street to Glavlit, the censorship office, every Tuesday to negotiate the limits of what was possible. And we're not doing that. But it's interesting, Gorbachev, someone we've gotten to know over these years – I think an extraordinary figure who changed the world, use a hackneyed phrase, but he's a 10% owner in Novaya Gazeta and was instrumental in its founding. And, I think Putin misspoke terribly. It sounded so cruel when he said that in her death, Anna Politkovskaya had more influence. It was something ugly like that. But the sad part of it is that Novaya Gazeta is a tiny outpost in a sea of conformity or state-regulated television. We don't have state-regulated television here, but The Nation is kind of a voice for views that are not expressed in the mainstream media and for taking on the powers that be. So that's where I see more of a parallel.
You mentioned your friendship with Gorbachev. How did you get to know him, and what kind of individual is he as a person?
I think we met him at an editorial meeting at Literary Gazette, again, one of the good newspapers in Moscow. And in these past years, we go to see him at his foundation office. He has very strong views. I mean, he has strong views about what is going wrong, what is going right in the world. But what he tried to do, for example, at Reykjavik, trying to abolish nuclear weapons, thinking heretically. I mean, I think, I see... And so he's thinking about the world as it could be. He's an extraordinary idealist. And what you have to think about is, how did a man like Gorbachev emerge from the Communist Party? Because he was a Communist Party apparatchik. He's formed the Global Green USA and Global Green International. He cares deeply about environmental issues. He's doing very good work in that area. He's a man, as you may recall, who could hold a 3-hour press conference without taking a breath. He still talks energetically, passionately, angrily about what was squandered in the post-Cold War period. And he's doing, I think, good things with his foundation among younger scholars. The sadness, the tragedy, is that he has been linked in Russian minds with Yeltsin and the Yeltsin era. And how he retrieves his legacy in Russia, I think he cares deeply about. He's very torn about his relationship with Putin, but Putin at least gives him respect. There was great hatred of Yeltsin and lack of respect. And I think a great tragedy for Gorbachev in these last years was the loss of his wife, Raisa Gorbachev, who was a complicated figure in Russia because of the complicated attitudes toward wives and women. I remember she played a role. I'll never forget being in Moscow when Pravda had her on the front page. Gorbachev went to meet Gandhi and his wife, and there was such consternation. She should be at home, you know, or like Nina Khrushcheva. But she made her mark, and I think in her passing, the Russians came to terms with her legacy. The last story I would tell is we take our daughter to see Gorbachev occasionally, and he turned to her at a meeting. We're all sitting in chairs. He turned to her last year and he said, "Nika," and she was 15, "have you found your true love yet?" Because when you do, you should really, you know, act on it. And Steve, my husband, who is not one to be intimidated and is quite outspoken, was speechless because he's not about to say, Mikhail Sergeyevich, what are you talking about? Don't talk to our daughter that way. Anyway, he's a very warm, warm person who I think is continuing to do great work and is like, in my view, our best ex-president, Jimmy Carter, not going to golf courses, but speaking about the critical issues of our time.
Let's listen to some more of your favorite music. This next one is a selection by John Mellencamp. Now, there's an obvious Indiana connection, but why this particular piece of music?
Well, John Mellencamp is many things. I believe it's the 25th anniversary of Farm Aid, truly extraordinary grassroots musical group, which has contributed over these years to helping farmers who have lost their livelihood as so much of our world has become conglomeratized, corporatized, and farmers losing their livelihood to agribusiness. So I think what he's doing with his talents is a very generous and wonderful thing. And the song speaks to, I think, farmers losing their land and their way as the country changes around them.
That was Rain on the Scarecrow by John Mellencamp. Our guest on Profiles today is Katrina Vandenhuvel, the editor and publisher of The Nation. Katrina, you must be one of the very few women editors, if perhaps the only one, of a major political journal. Why is that?
Well, until recently, Owen, it's true, I was the only woman editor of a political magazine journal. Newsweek, Time, U.S. News, I don't think there's been a woman editor. But even among the smaller publications, the thought leaders, the opinion magazines, Mother Jones now has two women editors. It's a different publication. I think there's been the conception of political debate may be that it's testosterone-powered food fight, you know, and women aren't equipped to engage in that. There are many kinds of engagement in political debate, many kinds of commentaries and leading a political magazine. Why aren't there more women columnists? Why aren't there more women commentators? Why aren't there more women on our TV screens, not just as anchors, but as commentators? So I think it's a general problem. It's changing. It's changing too slowly. I'm proud at The Nation that three of our leading columnists are women, very strongly opinionated, writing about a range of issues. Naomi Klein on geopolitics, Katha Pollitt on culture and feminism and politics, and Patricia Williams on legal issues, on race and identity. So we got it. You know, we have to do better. But I'm not the first woman editor. Frieda Kirschway was an extraordinary editor at a very complicated time, World War II, And then the McCarthy era, at a moment when the nation nearly didn't exist because our printer came under such fire. The printer wouldn't publish us anymore. So we found a friendly colleague in Alabama. And for a year, the copy was shipped to Alabama and then back to New York. But we survived.
I wonder if in Frieda Kirchwey's biography, as I recall, she is described as when she took on the role as editor of The Nation, she basically set aside her personal life, no children, and basically saying that in order to be professional, I have to give up the rest of my life.
Well, my memory is she had one child. I may be wrong, Owen, but let us hope that the times have changed enough that there is an ability to balance work and family. I can tell you The Nation is consuming, but I can also tell you that one can go mad if you don't have a way, like the music we're listening to. I do listen to music. I try to read a novel every 6 months and find other ways of engaging. And I'm editing a book. I'm also involved with a documentary on New Orleans. So you find other entry points related to the magazine, but you also have to find other ways. The funny story about Frieda Kirchwey is that she was also publisher. And the unusual part of the place like The Nation is that the owner of the magazine at that time was a man named Morris Wertheim, a famous financier, had three daughters. One was Barbara Tuchman, the historian. So there was a huge fight at The Nation. We have big internal editorial disputes, often splaying into the pages, about Roosevelt's, quote, court packing plan. There was big, you know, some supported, others didn't. Well, he was so upset with The Nation's support, particularly Frieda Kirchwey's editorial support of Roosevelt's plan, that he said, I can't deal with this magazine anymore. But he didn't sell it, like, to a Rupert Murdoch. He said, I'm going to sell it to you. You put the money together. So he even lent her the money to buy it. So it's in the tradition of The Nation, I think one reason it survived for 142 years is that it's never been captive to the more conventional attributes of publishing, meaning, you know, 10% profit margins now, 20%. But it's in the public interest and a public spirit and keeping that going.
One thing that characterized The Nation for a long time was a very conservative visual look, nothing on the cover. And when you came in as editor, did you change that? Was that something that you thought had to be done?
I did. I mean, I think it had a very – well, first of all, with 142 years of history, you can find precedents for anything. And there were covers at different points. Now, if you're please come to our conference room in New York. We have a cover from every decade. The first issue of The Nation is just all type, and it has a great first sentence. The week was particularly barren of exciting events. I mean, there's a hyped – but we've in the 20s, 30s, 40s, we had some great illustrators, great covers. So I drew on that tradition, even though the sort of more graphic Bauhaus graphic design, which Victor Novasky brought in in 1978, was designed by Milton Glaser, one of the great graphic designers of our time. I Love New York being one of his. But I thought a cover signaled, here's the important story of the week. Here's some great graphic or photograph. And we're even... You caught me at a moment. Next week, we're launching a slightly new design, again, drawing, hearkening back to a different logo, a little more graphic. But you know what? We're going to keep our paper. We're not going to go slick. In the spirit of The Nation, sort of tabloid underground, you'll never slide on The Nation when you get out of bed. Just kind of moving it a little bit. But we're not going to, you know, we don't want to compete with Vanity Fair. We believe in the power of the word, but just to open it up a little for readers.
It must be a challenge with a publication like The Nation to figure out when it's coming out every week how to determine an agenda, because don't you have to plan ahead to some degree that makes it hard to associate with real current events?
The Nation is a mix every week. There's a judgment call, obviously. There's a judgment call every day, but the lead editorial is often the news of the day. What is the nation's perspective, for example, this week as this Petraeus report on Iraq comes out? What are we calling for to counter or to put that in perspective? But then there's always every week in The Nation something off the news, which there should be. Jonathan Schell, for example, our peace and disarmament correspondent, is going to have a piece thinking about what's happened to disarmament? Or then we'll have election coverage, but doing it in a different way, not privileging the money primary, for example, or the horse race, but the ideas primary. So having a mix every week of what's in the news, what should be, you know, what's off the radar but we think is in the news, giving coverage, for example, to some organizing effort, which isn't getting attention in the mainstream press. And then, of course, a third of the magazine every week is cultural, book reviews. Arthur Danto, one of the great art critics in the United States, Stuart Klawans, who just won a National Magazine Award for film criticism. So you have the mix of the cultural and the political. It is one of the toughest parts of my job, though, I have to say, is I don't know if you feel this way, Owen, but I read three newspapers by 8:30 every morning. I do that before the web. I'm still newspaper print. There's so many outrages. You know, you don't know where to turn. But it's a moment also where you have to kind of put forth a different vision of a world or a politics, you know, that you think is not being discussed. So it's balancing the exposure of that outrage, the week in perspective, what's not on the radar, a little bit of something affirmative people can look at and say, hey, this is interesting, this is going on. Maybe this is going to lead to some change. And then, you know, we have every week too much and too little space and angry writers. When is my piece going to get in? And so you deal with all of that too.
That has to be a problem, managing with those writers who are strong writers who have strong opinions. It must be like kind of trying to shepherd prima donnas.
Well, I mean, I was talking very mundanely about just we have so much good material but so little space. But I'll tell you what's happened in these last weeks and months. The Nation, in many ways, it's a forum for conversation, debate, disagreement among the left, liberal, progressive, free-thinking, even conservatives with a conscience community. So you have debates around. There's not a monolithic party line. I mean, people sometimes think the Nation left. No, I mean, it's an independent, committed journalistic publication. But there are disagreements at the moment among our writers and editors about whether impeachment should be the top priority. There are disagreements about what's happening in Venezuela, you know, where democracy aligns with the economic justice. There's disagreement about Cindy Sheehan's candidacy. I don't know if your listeners have followed, but, you know, whether she was important in a movement and shouldn't really be running for office because it's not the best use of her great strengths and talents. So it's not a monolith. There are some core values and issues, but it's, you know, how realistic is our foreign policy approach or how idealistic human rights versus, you know, real politique. These are all issues which we want to grapple with, and we are thinking of even starting a kind of point-counterpoint section because these are moments to sort of thrash out. Maybe there is a synthesis down the road, but at the moment to think aloud about some of these issues.
Let's take a break here for your final selection of music, Respect by Aretha Franklin. Why this one?
Well, I find it just a kind of anthem as a woman. It's a sense of the respect I think all women should be accorded in this country. But I love Aretha Franklin. It's a voice of soul and voice of strength. And I think we would all do a lot better if there was a sort of respect and a generosity of spirit and less mean-spiritedness in the way a lot of our political dialogue is conducted. I think there's been a degeneration of sort of political speech and debate, and some respect would help a lot.
Just a little bit.
That was Respect by Aretha Franklin. Music chosen by our guest, Katrina Vandenhoevel, the editor and publisher of The Nation. Your circulation has jumped since George W. Bush came into office. Is it going to decline after the next presidential election?
Let me put it this way. This circulation has increased, I think, by 100% in the last 7 years, and George W. Bush was a huge factor. But I think another factor, Owen, is that there's been great, people look at what the media has failed to do, and they were looking for sources of news they could trust, of news around issues they cared about. And so I think that sense of the failures of the media and the role the nation has stepped into play will keep us going strong. I think we will take on, there's some crusading that we continue to explore and do that will not, will continue our, will keep our circulation going. We're not just there as an oppositionist publication. I also think I have to say that the circulation of the nation did decline a little when Clinton came into office, and I'm not talking Hillary, I'm talking Bill. I think people learn from that experience that you have to hold politicians of all parties accountable. And if you think about the current parameters of our debate and discussion, I think it's great that the Democratic candidates, the front runners, all of them get up on that stage and talk about what kind of affordable universal health care we should have, as opposed to the Republicans who are talking about how best to torture people. But at the same time, if you think about it, no leading Democratic candidate is talking about a defense budget that is greater than all of the other, every other country's defense budget combined. No one is challenging the fact that, we can't just be deficit reduction. We need public investment agenda. No one's thinking about sort of America's role in the world economically in ways that the nation as a publication, not a party, can do. So we will play a role, whatever happens when Bush leaves office. And what I want to make sure is that the nation is a vigorous part of the debate about building a progressive, liberal, more sane, more just country. So, there'll be different elements, but I don't think we're going to see a real decline.
And how do you persuade what has come to be called the mainstream media that they should pay attention to what the nation is writing about? There have been these surveys that have been done on Sunday talk shows that it's primarily moderates or moderate conservatives who are invited to be on the program, which would seem to leave the nation and its adherents out.
Well, I call that a suffocating consensus. And I think that, there's a great hunger in this country for outside the beltway thinking because that is so narrow. Now, I do some of those talk shows, so I get a personal chance to break through that barrier. But I think the nation has broken through in these last 10, 12 years. It's quoted more in the mainstream press. It's, brought into some of the political debate and dialogue. One of our recent cover stories was the subject of a congressional hearing just a few months ago. This was a story on military vets and how the Army had misdiagnosed their post-traumatic stress syndrome as pre-existing conditions so they wouldn't get disability benefits. We have the power to drive that kind of story into a congressional hearing. Bob Herbert of the New York Times did a full column on another investigative report we did just a month ago, a story about the horrors of this occupation and how U.S. troops have been complicit in atrocities against Iraqi civilians based on interviews with 50 military veterans on the record. So there's the ability to drive some of this into the mainstream. But, the nation exists to challenge the downsized politics of excluded alternatives. And that's so much of what we should not accept. And I think people are ready to see through sort of the emperor has no clothes. And I'm not just talking about Bush. I'm talking about too much of what is sort of treated as our, what's permissible in our political dialogue and system.
Some people say the future of political discussion is not in the print media, but on the web. Do you view the web as a threat?
No, but I will say that The Nation, the magazine, remains the center, the anchor, the core. But we have a very active, thriving website with about 1 million people who come to it every month. And we are building it because we see it as a way to amplify our ideas and also interact with a community, because The Nation is not just a magazine, it is a community. And we have a Nation book imprint. We have a Nation radio show. We have all kinds of events to amplify the Nation's voice. So we're not sitting still. But I think for the long term, print will be an important part of our lives. After all, so much of what is on the internet now, 95% of it is building on what's in print. It's like people riffing off what's in print, people holding the mainstream media accountable. There's a little bit of a vigilante quality. There's a lot of entertainment. But I think they're also exciting things. But we're part of making use of that to amplify the Nation's ideas.
You've obviously talked a lot about The Nation, very close to your heart. But what else do you read? What should somebody read to be broadly informed?
I try and read as widely and broadly as I can. I mean, I read all of the magazines of opinion, all of them. I mean, you know, the Weekly Standard, the National Review, and of course, you know, ones closer to my heart in these times are Mother Jones. I think the New Republic lost its way around the war in particular, has done a lot of mea culpas. I do read what's on the web, but I read The Economist, I read The Atlantic, I read Harper's. I read Russian newspapers. I read Le Monde Diplomatique. And I read many newspapers, Christian Science Monitor, The Washington Post, The New York Times, The LA Times. I wish I could read more regional papers. And every year I vow that we'll get the great interns who come through The Nation. By the way, we've had 600 interns since 1978, and they've gone into all kinds of places in the media. But that every editorial meeting, they'd be assigned to take on one regional newspaper, because I think there are things going on in this country that we lose sight of, or regional, some, you know, publication, some alternative. So I try and read as much as I can. And I think people find their way to what intrigues them, moves them, they feel simpatico with. But I would also argue that you should read what provokes and what angers you and what makes you think and forces you to think hard about your own ideas.
Do you see yourself staying with The Nation until you retire from public life?
I see myself as ensuring that The Nation thrives and grows in these next years. You know, we have an interesting structure. We have a few partners. We have a circle of over 100 people who contribute a little every year to The Nation.
And those partners, some of them pretty well known.
Yeah, Paul Newman has been a great partner in these last 10, 12 years. He came in through one of our most esteemed and beloved writers, E.L. Doctorow, who had gone to college with Paul Newman at Kenyon, and that was the tie. Newman being one of the decent men of our times, good actor too. So I see myself ensuring that The Nation survive and thrive as a voice, as an alternative, as an antidote to some of the suffocating consensus we talked about. I could see myself taking off in different ways while ensuring that The Nation is in good hands, but I feel responsible as publisher and as part owner of The Nation for its future. It's going to be tricky times thinking through. You did mention the internet. I see the magazine in print as the anchor for a long period. But there will be, you know, strategic thinking. And also part of what I'm doing in Bloomington is we're working to bring in younger readers, and we have found a good audience. They, of course, do come to the internet more frequently, but, you know, you bring them in, you find a way to engage them, and I think you have readers for life.
Our guest today on Profiles has been Katrina VandenHeuvel, the editor and publisher of The Nation. Katrina, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening. I'm Owen Johnson.
The program you just heard was recorded in September of 2007. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.